Welcome back to Booked. Thank you for downloading this weekly podcast show about books and, well, everything a little bit cultured. We're delighted to have you back. Back in September, the publication of Martin Aston's History of the Iconic 4AD record label, Facing the Other Way, was celebrated with a special party at Rough Trade East in London. And for those of you out there who have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about, 4AD is a British independent record label which was founded in 1979 by Ivo Watts Russell and Peter Kent, originally funded by Beggars Banquet Records. 4AD also formed part of the Beggars Group, along with Matador Records, Rough Trade Records and XL Recordings. This rich tapestry of the label's history was recently detailed by Martin Aston, and at Rough Trade East, a group interview took place amongst fans and artists involved in 4AD, past and present. On stage, the publisher Scott Pack interviewed Matt Johnson of The, Simon Raymond of Cocteau Twins and Mickey Berigny of Lush, with a special cameo at the end from the author himself. Here now is an exclusive recording of the event, and this podcast just happens to coincide with publication of a very, very special signed and numbered limited edition version of the book with the cover design by the great Vaughan Oliver.
It's fantastic to celebrate this amazing label, and lots of people have come here to do so. And the book itself is essentially a history of the 80s and 90s. Of the 4AD, which is Ivo's reign, shall we call it. So I've got a couple of questions for all of you, and then I've got a few questions for each of you individually. But I'd love to hear from each of you as to when you first met Ivo and what you made of him when you did. So Mickey, perhaps we could start with you.
God, I'm trying to remember the first meeting, actually. Emma was the one who was more in with the music business and knew all the kind of, you know, the hot and happening people. So she probably met him first. I can't remember when I first met him. I know he was quite an avuncular presence. I know that's the word that crops up in the book throughout. But he was very kind and he was very sweet and, you know, we needed a lot of love and care and he provided that, you know.
Excellent. Matt, can you remember?
Yeah, I think it was the 101 Club in Clapham, I think. We'd been introduced to 4AD via Graham Lewis and Bruce Gilbert from Wire, and I think we were doing a gig at the Clapham 101 Club, and he came down to see us play. I think it is, but, you know, it's over 30 years ago now, and it's hard to remember, but that's my memory. A very thoughtful chap, very polite, gentle, nice guy, really. Like, you know, felt comfortable with him straight away.
Simon?
Well, my first job after leaving school was luckily enough at Beggars Banquet Record Shop in Earls Court, and that shop had been open, I think, about 6 years when I turned up there one Saturday afternoon and asked if I could get a Saturday job there, and I did a couple of Saturdays and then ended up getting offered a full-time job, and 4AD and Situation 2 and Beggars were upstairs in the office above the shop, and it was an incredible shop. It was by that point, not when it first started, but by that point it was selling just punk and reggae records, and you know, no better time to be in London than 1980 when I got that job, and I met Ivo through there. Partially, I guess he was just walking through the shop every morning to go. You had to go through the shop to get to the office upstairs, so that's kind of how we just met, and then ended up being in a band on Situation 2, which was another label upstairs.
Thank you. Matt, I hope you don't mind me saying so, but you're not necessarily associated with 4AD.
No.
But you were there in the very early days and can probably shed some light on how it was set up then. How did you go about getting signed? What happened to bring you to the label?
Well, it's an interesting period, really, in British music, because the independent music scene was quite compact in those days. And I had sort of a relationship with Cherry Red. I used to go up there a lot and used to go over to Rough Trade, sit with Jeff Travis, play demos. A lot of those people were very encouraging, you know, a lot of people knew each other. And the Beggars shop, I remember that well, going over there and sitting upstairs, and it was quite sort of mildly sort of chaotic but energetic. But it was an interesting time because also, I got involved in Some Bizarre as well, but also knew Daniel Miller. So it was a very... The London independent scene was very compact. And in in the years since, you would say that it's grown exponentially, really. It's almost like cells dividing. I couldn't keep track of the amount of people that invite. In fact, it's hard to find someone that's not in a band now, isn't it? But in those days, it was more of a sort of compact situation. And it was really through the guys in Wire that led me to 4AD. And, you know, we did a single for them, which was produced by Bruce Gilbert and Graham Lewis. And, you know, it moved on from there, really. And I still remember the phone call from Ivo when he phoned up and said, do you fancy doing an album? You know, and it was so exciting. And so that was 1980 for the single, 1981 for the album. And that was really before the identity of 4AD, you know, with Vaughan Oliver's artwork and everything, really established it. So it was really the early days. There was, you know, Bauhaus, Modern English, a few projects like that. But I really enjoyed my time on the label, though. I thought it was a terrific label. But I've obviously become more associated with Sun Bazaar and then moved on to Sony, of course.
So what were your impressions of it? How many people were there? Was it a really small group?
Yeah, I mean, Ivo was more... I knew Peter as well, but he then formed Situation 2, didn't he, Peter? But it was a small office. It was sort of slightly sort of mildly chaotic, and I just used to sit up there playing Ivo the demos. There'd be people working away in the background. A good, you know, cottage industry type atmosphere, really. You know, those days, like I said, I used to spend a lot of time in a lot of the labels, just taking demos around, and it was a great time. Everybody was very encouraging, you know, and a lot of the bands knew each other as well.
And in the book, you're quoted as saying, I hope correctly, you're quoted as saying that you sometimes thought you don't regret leaving 4AD, but you sometimes imagine how your career may have unfolded if you'd stayed for a couple of extra albums
To be honest, I had a great time on Sony, really. I was given a lot of artistic freedom. But in some ways, I remember having the conversation with Ivo, you know, when the deal from CBS, as it was in those days, came in. And Ivo said, well, you know, maybe it's a bit too soon. You know, you could, you know, develop yourself more here. Yeah, it's not a regret of mine because things went absolutely fine, but you do sometimes wonder about alternative lives, alternative realities.
And when the took off, he was very reluctant to put the name on your album, is that right?
Yeah, he was. I mean, the reason I did that, because I wanted it to be wrapped with the other albums. It was always stuck by itself under Matt Johnson, and I just thought, yeah, I'd rather it sell more copies. And Ivo was just like, no, we don't want to do that. People are think it's me that I'm cashing in. And I said, no, we'll just say that I said that we could do it. And so he was very clear about that. I thought that was...
He put a disclaimer on it.
He did. He insisted on putting a disclaimer. And I thought that was very sweet, really, and a sign of his integrity. It's very unusual to find a situation like that where somebody's... It doesn't want to sell many records.
Well, there's a broader question there for all of you. 4AD and Ivo were notorious for the artistic integrity. Was there ever a time when you actually felt that wasn't helping you? Was there ever a time you thought, oh, God, come on, I'd be happy to sell out in this regard, but or did you feel that it protected you and actually it helped you?
Could you say that again?
So the whole artistic integrity thing, the pack, everything that he put in, Ivo would often make decisions which perhaps weren't commercial decisions, but they might have been the right artistic ones. Oh, as the artist, were you ever thinking, I wish you'd done something else, or was that protective in some way?
Oh, no, he was very, you know, he was very generous with his opinions, but he always let the artist, as far as, you know, my experience goes, he was very... you know, just let us get on with it, really. And if we were speaking with Vaughan about a design for a sleeve or whatever, he would let us make those decisions, and he wouldn't really be involved at all. I have to say that, you know, there's a lot of... about the Coctitlan story is obviously a long and complex one, and we don't even have any time at all to go into it, so I won't bother. But just to sort of paraphrase it a little bit, I think people in the press have often just focus on all the negative things. There was obviously a huge period of time that we were on the label that was supremely positive. And yes, it didn't end particularly well, but then obviously things don't end particularly well because then there wouldn't be an end. And I think, you know, at the beginning, certainly the first several years, Ivo was an incredibly important person in all of our lives. For me, you know, not just as a music fan and as somebody I was signed to as a musician, but somebody I actually learnt an awful lot of other stuff from. He was several years older, but he had great taste in music. That's obvious, but also in films and art and sculpture and books and I mean, he took me to an all day or is it an all night Tarkovsky thing at this Curzon Cinema. I mean, I never even heard of Tarkovsky at the age of whatever 22, but to be experiencing that kind of stuff at that age did have a very lasting effect on me, and I still have a lot of the taste now that he partly is responsible for, and I think we'd all sort of probably say that Ivo was really one of the most tasteful people out there, and also a really fantastic chap, for us at that point of development. Yeah. And I can't ever remember him getting involved and saying, "Well, I don't think you should do that," or "Why don't you try this?" He just literally let us get on with it totally, and that's the beauty of independence. That's the beauty of independent labels, is that your A&R person, even though Ivo, he was a label boss, but he was also the A&R guy. He never, unless you asked him to, he never stepped in and said, "I think you should do this, by the way, because that sounds like a pile of crap," which is what most A&R guys do. And I think that's the beauty. We learnt our lessons, our mistakes. We made our mistakes in public. That's just how our band went. But he was very, very generous with his time.
And how did you hook up with Robin and Liz? How did your involvement in the Cocteau Twins begin?
Oh, just like one of those kind of things we all have in our lives, like beautiful little natural accidents, I was working in the beggar's shop downstairs, and Elizabeth and Robin and Will, the original bass player, had come down to deliver the... actually, it was a cassette in those days, a cassette of the album that they'd the demos of the album that they'd made, and they'd arrived at the shop really early, or they'd arrived at the label really early, not realizing there was a shop there. And I was in the shop early and took the cassette off them and said I'd give it to Ivo when he came in, and that was my first physical introduction to the band. And then Ivo and I used to go to a lot of concerts together, in the early 80s. And before I joined the band in 1983, I think it was, we were going to a lot of shows together all around the country, and we went and saw Cocteau a lot, and we just all became mates, and it seemed a kind of natural progression, I suppose. They were a fan of my old band, and I kind of liked their band, and one thing led to another, and it just happened very, very naturally, which most of the best things do.
And now you've subsequently gone on to form your own record label, Bella Union. And has that experience, does that help you look back at that time and sort of see the differences? Does it give you a perspective that perhaps you wouldn't have had otherwise?
How to answer diplomatically?
You don't have to answer diplomatically.
I think with anything in life, as you get older, you learn a lot more about stuff from the mistakes either that you made or that you've seen being made. And I think the ethos of Bella Union, if there is one, is just it's a label that I'd like to have been signed to. And I don't really need to say any more about it than that.
That's fair enough. Mickey.
Yes.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about Alphabet Soup?
Oh.
was it really 5p?
It was 5p. So it was me and Emma when we were about 15. And we would go to gigs, and we didn't know anyone, and we were quite shy. And the best way to get to know people, we thought, was to write a quite obnoxious fanzine and tout it around at gigs and sell it. And that's what we did.
And the strap line was?
It may be shit, but it's only 5p.
Excellent.
Which is quite honest, I think.
That's a beautiful, yeah, I like that. That's a lot. I might have to use that on some of the books I publish, but with a higher price.
I do remember we interviewed Exmal Deutschland once, and I think we were in their hotel room. Where's Emma? She might remember.
Were we really late?
We were awful at interviews. We just used to sit there kind of terrified and just sort of flash this list of questions at people and mumble at each other and nudge each other, and I think they were all getting ready and half dressed. It was a young man's fantasy, but we were kind of so scared. Didn't think to take any photos, but
So you would have been very familiar with the 4AD label and the bands before you even got close to signing.
Yes, well, I was astonished that Ivor was even vaguely interested in signing us. It felt incredibly flattering. Mm. So,
and is it true that a shared love, Emma may or may not confirm, a shared love of Haircut 100 was somehow involved in you two developing a friendship?
Well, not really.
We were
at school together, and that we went to see Haircut 100, I think, when it was Emma's birthday. But we weren't that crazy about them. We were just obsessed with any music.
Anyway.
So we'd be quite happy to go and see, like, the Thompson Twins on Tuesday and then go and see, like, I don't know, Flux of Pink Indians on Thursday. And
Described the ultimate 80s reunion night, which I'm sure they're probably all appearing somewhere this very evening. But it's true that neither of you were keen to sing originally in the original lineup?
Oh, God, no. Well, we had Meriel, who was in the Pale Saints. She was our original singer. And to be honest, we all got together as just, you know, I was at North London Poly and, like, do you want to join a band? And, like, yeah, all right, you know. And so Meriel was the singer, blah, 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 but she was a bit kind of... She was having a serious relationship, you know, and so wasn't that available, and in the end, it wasn't going to work. So we did advertise. We put an advert in the Melody Maker, you know, with all the right references, yep. And we had a rehearsal, and five complete maniacs turned up, and a couple of them seemed all right, and then we went to the pub with them, and one of them, I remember, was... like a complete racist, which we didn't realise till after about three pints. And another one was claustrophobic, so she said we had to pay for her cabs to go everywhere. So in the end, we just couldn't find anyone. So
By default,
yes.
Ended up okay?
Yeah.
Not bad. How do you look back on your time with Lux? Because I think we were talking earlier, but in the book it mentions that Scar was the last 4AD release of the 80s. So effectively, most of your career with 4AD was in the 90s, which was sort of a different period for the label. It was branching out into different areas, and you were delivering chart success, of course. Do you remember these days?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, our kind of, you know, career was quite up and down. It was very sort of dazzling for us. Mm. We were a bit too soon in the public eye.
Yeah.
And Ivo was... And 4AD as a label was great for us for that reason. You know, they really guided us. And any mistakes we made were kind of... You know, we were a bit shielded. It really did help us to be there. We wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes if we'd have been signed to a major.
Yeah. And that, from reading the book... That's what comes out about Ivo, this idea of nurturing talent and allowing them to sometimes make mistakes if you could learn from them. And I suppose there's good and bad aspects to that, I guess. One of the other features, of course, of the label was Vaughan Oliver's design, which didn't really kick in, Matt, until after you'd gone, but was sort of integral to the look of a lot of what Cocteau Twins and Lush did. What was it like working with Vaughan? He's not here this evening because he's poorly, so we could have... got his idea, his version of that as well. What was it like working with him? I say that having worked with him on the cover of the book, so...
It's a whole nother in-store, I think, that one. Well, you know, he's an incredible person, Vaughan, and many of the people in this room will know him personally, and, you know, the stories that will undoubtedly be in the book. So
they most certainly are.
Recommend you pick the book up and just go to the Vaughan Oliver section and be entertained for a good period of time. He was a really funny boy, massively talented. I mean, it was only recently that he actually started working on a computer. You know, most graphic designers, as soon as computers came in the early 90s, sort of scrapped the draftsman's board and got into Macs and designing on Macs. Vaughan didn't, you know, he carried on working on huge big boards and stuff forever. And he's very methodical, very, very thoughtful, hugely imaginative. I mean, some of the sleeves for Lush, for my band, Colourbox, you know, those sleeves in particular were actually so amazing, the sort of Japanese prints and pages.
Do you have a favourite that wasn't one of yours? Was there one that you loved?
I love the Breeders album, Pod.
Is that the right title?
Yeah.
Yes. I love that. I love the Pixies. Doolittle. It's pretty amazing. Well, I mean, you know, I change my mind every day. His sleeves were so iconic, and really, I think if we look at going to a bookshop, you know, today, and just look at graphic design on book covers, and you'll see the influence of Vaughan Oliver, and it's been there for 20 years. He's definitely one of the greatest graphic designers there's ever been. Working with him was certainly a challenge. I wouldn't hide behind the fact that it was not always easy sitting down and having conversations about art with him, because, you know, he has super strong opinions. And even though we didn't really have any about our actual artwork until we saw his, that still sometimes caused some conflicts. And I mean, I think anyone that's super creative, when you put out an idea there and the reaction to it isn't 100% positive, you know, sometimes you're going to get into a bit of a row if the people that you're working with are also quite adamant that they're correct.
If it's any consolation as a book publisher, authors are worse. Yeah. My character doesn't have brown hair, so the person on the cover can't have brown hair. Well, it's not a literal anyway. Not to worry. Yeah. The Lush covers were fantastic as well. How much input did you have, or was it a case of he would work something up and bring it to you, or how involved did you get?
Yeah, they did it all. Yeah. I mean, I think on the Scar stuff, you know, there was always a bit of a mucky twist to the stuff that he did for us. So if you look on the inner sleeve of Scar, there's a kind of these little Japanese kind of pictogram things, and it's got little girl or something, and then it's got tongue opposite it, you know, and when you fold up the sleeve, clearly, you know, there's an innuendo there. And I do remember the one time where we thought, okay, that's enough, was when we did Mad Love. And, you know, you look at it and it's all sort of scratchy things and lovely swirly colours, but basically it's a willy, you know, and a badge somewhere. And on the kind of, on the centre sort of the record, I think it was basically a bum with a big fart coming out, you know, and I think we did go, oh, no, just that, not that one. I can deal with the willy and I can deal with the vagina, but not that one.
Excellent stuff. Well, we'd love to open it up to questions from the audience, if anyone's got any questions. Now, I think the best way of doing this is if you raise your hands and I'll try and pick you out, and then basically shout so we can all hear you, because the worst thing in the world is when the audience can't hear the question, but we might repeat it. Ed, unless no one's got any questions, of course. Would anyone like to ask a question of any of our guests this evening? Well, there's a rumble. Look, everyone's very shy. I have got other questions I can ask.
They're inspired by Ivo's reclusiveness.
I think that might be. I think that might be the case. Anyone got any questions they want to ask?
Yeah, when's Matt going to do a new album?
There we go.
Funny you should ask that. It's being written at the moment. You'll be pleased to learn.
Oh, we have a hand up. Yes, sir.
And in a follow-up to that, will it ever be toured live?
Oh, that's a difficult question. Yes.
Great.
Any 30th anniversaries coming up?
How did you know? Yes, there is a Soul Mining, actually, box set. We're just working on that at the moment with Sony.
And any chance in 3 years' time you release the film on...
That will be sooner than 3 years, yeah, we're doing that. Yeah, there's a whole series of releases coming up. Fantastic. From the next sort of 2 years.
So that's a lot happening then.
Yeah, well, there's not only that, there's all sorts of things.
Because you're now a publisher, of course.
I am a publisher. I'm looking for some... No, I'm not looking for anyone. I just published a lovely book of my dad's memoirs, which went very well. But I realise how hard it is being a publisher.
It's very hard work. Oh, yes.
Stressing.
Never underestimate how difficult it is. Yes. Unless you're working with a brilliant author like Martin, of course. Yes.
Which I think we should give... while we're on the subject, Martin, he felt a bit reluctant to come on stage, but I think we should give him a big round of applause, because he's done a wonderful job. And I do think that this beautiful book will be seen as the essential handbook of 4AD Records in coming years. But I think it will. It's exhaustive. You've done a wonderful job putting it together.
I mean, I can't see. Anybody else wanting to take on?
No.
It's exhaustive. It definitely covers everything. We were saying earlier, it's not like histories of World War II where someone can write a new one every year and whatever. This covers everything. No one needs to do this again. And it's a beautiful book, thanks to yourself and Vaughan. Any other questions? I don't want any of you to go home thinking, shit, I should have asked this question. It was my one chance, and they're missing out. There you go, sir.
Did 4AD ever feel in competition with other indie labels at the time, such as Creative?
So was there ever... Did you ever get a sense of competition against some of the other indie labels at the time?
I don't think so, no. I think Ivor was very strong in his image, in his ideas and his identity. There wasn't... I think the independent community now, in a way, is stronger than it was back then. There weren't so many labels then. I mean, if you think that Beggars was probably one of the... I mean, what was it? The Lurkers was 1977, Martin? I think that was one of the first indie punk releases. And they were one of the first independent labels. And it's pretty incredible to think how they've grown over the years. And I think what makes 4AD so special, even now, is that the identity of the label and the brand, is just so iconic and so strong. And I don't think there was... I think if you've got a really good sense of what you're trying to do and your confidence in your own ability is there, then you shouldn't ever look outside of that anyway. And even... I buy loads of records on other labels. I know Martin does. I know other label owners. We all love each other's stuff, but we don't really feel in direct competition. And these days, we all sort of celebrate each other's, Pyrrhic victories.
Any other questions? Yes.
Do the panellists think that the ethos of the independent scene that is described in the book still exists, or has too much changed for there to be that kind of independently distributed alternative scene?
So does the ethos of independent music and an independent label as described in the book still exist, do we think?
Well, I don't know if music occupies such an important role with as many people, younger people, because of the advent of video games and the fact that the way that children listen, young people listen to their music. I'm not sure, really. I think there is a healthy independent scene. I mean, Simon would know better than me, really.
Yeah, I mean, I would counter that a little bit. I mean, I know what you're saying. I think maybe that's just an age thing. I think as we all get older, we have all more responsibilities in our lives. And I mean, there aren't a massive amount of kind of 18 to 25 year olds in this room, but if there were, I think they would argue that music is really important. Well, okay, there's a few. I think they would argue that music is still really important in their lives, and I think the independent scene is just as strong as it ever was. Personally, I feel that.
I think possibly how they discover it might be slightly different now, because it used to be a couple of radio shows, the local record shop and gigs, and that was it. That was the only, and the school playground, as you talked about it. But I think it's different.
I think
now.
It was a lot more cosy back then.
Yeah.
So I'm not massively up on this, but I imagine, it's great to have the internet and you can access what you want. But I think there was slightly more to it. It was, the labels and the people and the gigs and the fanzines and the, it was very much a scene, I think, that it became your world, whereas now I think, you can pick bits out of it that you like, which is great. It's just different, I suppose.
Any more questions? Anyone burning to ask one? Anyone a little bit shy? Someone just stroked their hair at the back there and I thought they were asking a question, but they're not. Well, here we go. Yes, sir.
In terms of the book, which is the hardest bit of the book to research
Hardest bit of the book to research and put together. Do you want to answer that now, Martin, or do you want to... There you go.
So I just stand here. Okay. The hardest part of the book to research... I think just getting hold of everybody took a while, because some people didn't get back to me. Somebody was off surfing for a few months, it seemed. and didn't really want to show interest, and then got talked into it, and it was fine. I was just incredibly lucky that Ivor gave me so much amazing access, and I spent a week with him, and that really sort of broke the back of getting everything in sort of in line, getting the kind of the structure of the book in terms of all the information, catalogue numbers, but it was just getting hold of everybody. I mean, I wanted to speak to pretty much everybody that I could who put out an EP, like at least an EP. There's a few people who only put out demos, and they had no involvement as such in 4AD. They didn't even meet Ivo or Peter, so there was really little point in actually talking to them. But everybody who put out an EP, and even some people who only did put out a single, I tracked down. So there's about, I think there's about 115 interviews in the book. So I guess the hardest part of it was just making sure that I got to speak to everybody. I mean, in this day and age, obviously with emails, it's a lot easier, but it's just finding people from maybe 30 years ago. I guess it just flowed from there. It didn't, I mean, in a way, it just flowed. It didn't, there was no point in which I got stuck. Because I had so much material, and I mean, it helped because I knew bands from having interviewed them back in the day. So I mean, I knew Throwing Muses, and I had, you know, I had interviewed Charles of the Pixies, and I had done a Wolfgang Press bio. So that kind of stuff. So there was a sort of natural way in to talk to people. I guess the hardest part was actually talking a couple of people round who didn't want to do it and didn't manage that. I guess that was the hardest part of it. Just didn't happen.
One of the striking things about the book is in almost every case how fondly people look back on their time, because a lot of these people are no longer with the label, and how fondly they look back at those times and how willing they were to talk about. I mean, I know some people weren't, but not that many. Most people were like, yeah, I'd love to. And there were a couple of bands who perhaps weren't particularly successful who were very philosophical about it, I thought.
Yeah, I think everybody had their moment at 4AD, whether they sold records or not. I think that they were made to feel loved. They were encouraged. I mean, it's funny that the only bands that really Ivo let go were the ones that sold records. That's the interesting part of it. But he felt that, you know, he basically didn't want to take up time talking about the next single or making a video. That, to him, was not the point. The point was the music, the object to, as he says, to sort of, you know, to have and to hold. That's why he got Vaughan involved so much, because you had this beautiful object and you had this housing, beautiful music. And then once you started talking about the business side of it, it watered it down, or it spoilt it, or it ruined it. And there were times that he just felt that he could see it growing to a point. That, and, you know, I mean, he actually says, I didn't want things to grow. That was his ethos.
Yep.
He didn't really want to sign bands. He kept saying to people, I really love your music, but I don't think I can do anything with you. And they'd be like, oh, okay, that's really interesting. So then he would call them up 6 weeks later and say, I can't stop listening to your music, but I don't think I can do anything with you, but can we keep in touch? And they were, you know, Kristen Hirsch tells his story about, she thought that the only way that you talked to record companies was if they were interested in you and actually wanted to put your record out. And, you know, she said Ivo would just call up and hear this English voice at the other end of the phone, and they would talk about anything but music. You know, they would just talk about, I don't know, cats, dogs, the weather. I don't know what they would, you know. But he couldn't, you know, he said any more than six bands at one time, and he got really nervous because he felt he couldn't give them what they needed. And he wasn't that kind of A&R man who would be socialising backstage, hanging out, all of that. You know, Ivor was known as the head of the label who didn't turn up, who wasn't at gigs. You know, that he, I mean, which is part of his nature. Yeah. But he did sign bands because he couldn't stop listening to their music, you know, whether it was Dead Can Dance or whether it was Throwing Muses. he couldn't stop because the music was that special that he had to. So that's what he, you know, in the end he would sign bands, but he picked and chose very carefully. You know, all the bands that were on the label were sort of trailblazers, I would say.
Yeah.
And it was when he stopped doing that and actually took notice of sort of trends and, as you say, you know, other labels. You know, it was bands and managers, in a sense, that wanted, because, you know, the underground crossed over, in a sense, become the overground, if that's the, or, you know, the mainstream. Mm. And so it was natural, you know, managers got involved. There was singles and videos and remixes, and it became the order of the day. And so as that increased, his personal involvement sort of decreased because he saw it as watering it all down.
Yeah.
And in the end, he just, I mean, he kind of gave up.
Yeah.
And he gave up, in a sense, when he moved to the States in one way.
Yeah.
He put himself at a distance from it, and he never sort of got back. So, you know, the label went on for another 7 years, but, I mean, he says he should have got out earlier, but he just couldn't let go, and understandably.
So we've probably got time for one more question from the audience, if there is anyone itching to ask one. You're a very uninquisitive lot, aren't you, I notice. Yes, sir.
Nathan.
Playing devil's advocate, but do you think there was ever a point in which the aesthetic, the Vaughan's aesthetic, overrode the band's aesthetic in themselves?
So was there ever a point when Vaughan's aesthetic overrode the band's?
Who? Are you asking anyone?
Anyone got a view of that?
Yeah. There were times when it certainly could have. I mean, we had some real battles with him with Sleeves, and in a way, you know, if you sort of think of Cocteau Twins music, a lot of people sort of associate the music in tandem with those iconic Sleeves, and in a way, in hindsight, now as a grown up, I can look back on it and say that it in a way he helped define our identity, really, because we didn't really have one. We were just three ugly fuckers who just stood on the stage staring at our shoes, just doing our thing, and we didn't really have a visual idea in our head, really. You know, behind all the billowing smoke and the lights, you know, we were just frightened rabbits. And I think the imagery that he developed, and let's face it, you know, it did most of the idea that people have in their mind about Cocteau Twins is to a large part down to his design. He gave us an identity that we ended up falling out with him about it in the end, because we didn't really want to be this sort of twee Victoriana thing that we felt he'd created. Even though at the time it seemed kind of all right, but then we found that our ideas clashed too much. I think there's bands where, I can think of a few bands where the imagery is certainly seems more important.
I think that the problem is that when you have a brand or an identity, and it's so strong that it can overwhelm a band that is on 4AD but doesn't want to be identified as 4AD, and that was the problem, because it was both a blessing and a curse being part of 4AD underneath that kind of brand ID. Really helped bands, and because it was so strong and so brilliant, but it overwhelmed bands because they didn't feel that they could be, they didn't feel that they were their own selves because they were part of this larger whole. And so it was both a positive and a negative, I guess. Is that fair enough?
So, just to wrap up, it was a bit of a lovey-dovey question, but do you have a particular memory? Is there one particular thing that strikes out, good or bad, about your time with 4AD? Is there something that you just think, that was it, that was the best moment, or that was the most exciting moment, or, oh my God, that was a disaster?
No, one of my fondest memories of Ivo is when we were recording, I think, I can't remember which tracks it was, Icing Up, and I can't remember what the other track, Like a Sun Rising Through My Garden. We were doing it at Spacewood Studios out in Cambridge, I think it was. And Ivo had his little blue Peugeot. We used to drive down there and sleep on the floor. Was it in a sort of church place? I can't remember. Do you remember a space? Yeah, we just sort of sleep on a couple of sleeping bags on the floor. And it was a lot of fun, though, those sessions, actually. You know, just chatting and laughing, and it was thoroughly enjoyable. I just remember him as a very, very nice man, really. I mean, that's why I agreed to talk about the book and come here tonight. He was a very important part of my career. Lovely guy. I've not seen him since, I think, about 2000, when I was last on tour, actually. But always a pleasure to see him, however infrequent it is. But probably that memory, sort of camping out in Spacewood Studios in a sort of intense creative period.
Fantastic. Yeah. Mickey? If you haven't got one, it's fine. You can pass.
I can't think of anything. I mean, I was just actually kind of fascinated by what you were saying about being subsumed by the label. But, I mean, I thought what was really interesting when we went to 4AD was meeting all the people and actually realising that they weren't like that. You know, you did think you were going to meet, like, the Cocteau twins, and they were going to be this sort of made out of crystal or something. And, you know, and there's Robin, like, off his fucking nut, and, you know, and Vaughan, who's just this kind of monster, oh, my God, you know, and it was hilarious. And actually, I think that was quite weird. A lot of the bands, most of the bands weren't precious at all in that way. They were actually much more grounded than bands on other label and much more self-effacing, and, oh, fuck off, just get me a drink or whatever. And it was really refreshing.
Simon?
Really, I didn't
think. Probably my favourite memory, my favourite time with Ivo on a personal level was the second This Mortal Coil record. Mm. I was quite heavily involved with the second album. Well, the first two, but he was working in Blackwing Studios, I think. Is that right? For the second record, and... because I play a little bit, not very well, of a few instruments. I helped him sort of get a lot of the tracks sort of underway, you know, with the sort of basic tracks, the bass and the pianos and a few bits of guitar here and there. So I just loved being in the studio with him on his own or with a couple of other people, just getting things started, because he was a very easy person as a producer. I mean, he probably wouldn't even... he'd feel uncomfortable being called a record producer, but he definitely had a great producer's ear, because he knew what he wanted it to sound like. He might not have known how to make the sounds himself, because he was no musician, but he knew how to sort of like cajole or encourage a great performance out of you. And I was still very young at that age. I didn't really know my way around the studio that much. And spending those couple of weeks with him was just basically him and John Fryer and me, and then a few other people coming in by day. It was a really special time. I look back on that really fondly, and in a way, it helped my development as a musician and as a producer myself, watching how they interacted with people. Brilliant.
Well, thank you very much. Before we thank our guests, Martin, I think, is going to go. You've got to go and stand behind the counter.
I will. What can...
You can, yeah.
Can I just say something?
Of course you can say something. Yeah, you go ahead. You wrote the bloody book. You can say whatever you want.
Okay. Like Ivo, my intention tonight was to kind of fade into the background, because, my feeling is that this is the story of 4AD, and I'd much rather hear the opinions of Simon, Matt and Mickey than hear my own voice. But I just want to say how grateful I am to you all for coming along. It really means an awful lot to me. Apart from taking part in the book and doing all the interviews, that you've turned up here tonight, which is fantastic. Thank you so much. And thank you to Scott for taking the weight off my shoulders by being the person to ask the questions very eloquently. And thank you, everybody, for turning up. And... that's my bit.
Good. Well, you need to shift your arse over there.
Special thanks to Neil Fraser for recording the event and allowing us to share it all with you. It really was a special recording, bringing together some of the rather pinnacle people housing some incredible talent which was, in essence, all about the music and not about the commercial gain. Facing the Other Way is available to buy, and the limited editions stamped with such figure by Vaughan Oliver's designs are balanced with such a rich sonic history that makes this collection on the post-punk record label more than just a book. It's an artefact, a veritable doorstop, steeped in music, design, colour, words, interviews, ideas, images and timelines. There's such colour on every single page. That's it for now. I hope you enjoyed listening to the show. Short but sweet, but we've got lots of other interviews that you can listen to, and if you're new to Booked, we'd love you to go and check us out on SoundCloud and iTunes, and we've also just launched our video channel on YouTube, which is Booked. Pretty simple, really. Cheers, and for now, I bid you farewell.
That was Booked. That was Booked. That was Booked.
Anybody else feel like a little...
Good. Well, you need to shift your ass over there.
Giggle.
That was Booked.